Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today I have one of my favorite people on. I love to have Dr. Marilyn Singleton come back, and it wouldn't be a new year without having her expertise and sage advice, because your voice, Marilyn, is very unique. And today we're going to be speaking about something that I think people really need to know about, and that's how COVID has affected seniors and the senior citizens' homes. And there's a lot of things coming out now about what was done and how that was used to control the narrative in my opinion, in some instances. But I wanted to get your take. You teach classes in the recognition of elder abuse and constitutional law for non-lawyers. So this is something that is right in your wheelhouse, and I wanted to get your take on it. So welcome for coming. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you back on.
Well, thank you for having me again. You know, it's one of my favorite things to do. I hate even having to talk about elder abuse. Some of the things that I saw when I was on the parole board, some of the things that people did to their own relatives, it makes you want to cringe. And let's just start with looking at it. By 2050, there will probably be 100 million people in the United States, 65 or older. What does that do to how people look at older people? You have some people that look at it, isn't it great? We're going to live longer. And then you have a whole nother group of people and say, isn't it awful? What a burden to have all those old people. And so we have to struggle with those two mindsets. Elder abuse has been happening for quite a while, and people even guess that maybe 1 in 10 elders are abused in one way or another, whether physically, verbally, sexually. And so it could be up to 5 million seniors every year. And mostly, it's not reported. The elder isn't going to report it if they still have their mental faculties, because they don't want to anger the family member if it was a family member that did it. And some elders, unfortunately, are in the position where they're victims of guardian abuse. And these are where court-appointed guardians just rob them blind because they have total control over their money. And so that's another quite scary thing. So let's look at some of the things that put a person at risk. And a lot of it's pretty obvious. The older you are, low income, so you don't have resources to have a really good person from a bonded agency to look out for you if you're impaired in any way. One of the things that it stunned me when I was on the parole board, you'd ask the people, did they have a job when they got out of jail? And this would be the women who were mostly just in jail for prostitution. And you'd say, well, what kind of job are you going to get? And they'd say, oh, I'm going to take care of the old lady down the street. So that's who's taking care of a lot of the older folks. And then, of course, if there's any functional debility at all, any kind of cognitive impairment, that those people are ripe for having their money stolen or just getting beaten up out of frustration. Because you kind of have to look at who's doing it. There's sadists, but then for the most part, it's people who are taking care of an elder. They're stressed out. They get burned out, and then they just lash out at the person and slap them silly. The biggest thing that's done is neglect. And let's say grandma's living in the house and she's up in her room. There have been cases where grandma is not fed, living in her own waste, and there was an awful case where finally the neighbors smelled something. This woman was not dead, but they had not cleaned up her room so much that the smell was leaking out the windows so the neighbors could hear. This neglect is, I don't know, it bothers me even more because the people think they're doing something good. They go to church, they tell their friends, oh yes, my mother lives in my home. And so people are patting them on the top of the head like, aren't you a saint? You're mm-hmm. taking care of your mother. And of course, they're in a room by themselves. And this is something that starts to kind of lead into what happened with COVID. One of the big risk factors for elder abuse is isolation. What did they tell poor people to do during COVID? Stay home. Don't leave. Stay by yourself. So what happens? People are isolated for so long. And we saw it starting to happen more with COVID. You have one, oh, they're always such a nice person who comes up to the house with some food. And the next thing you know, that nice person is robbing the elder blind. But the elder doesn't care because they're just glad to see another human being. So
That's so devastating. I mean, you just described something that, unless you're from the outside in, you can't see it all the time. And is there, I mean, you mentioned the neighbors, and that's really when it's over the top. Is there any way you can get subtle cues that if you're paying attention, you can pick them up?
Well, interestingly, certainly in the hospital, one of the first things we see in the hospital is when you have a caregiver that never leaves the elder's side. And at first you think, oh, this person is a very caring person. They mm-hmm. want to make sure that old auntie is just fine. But what they're doing is they make sure the person can't speak to anyone else alone. And as a neighbor, churchgoer or something, that ends up being, let's say, the number one thing people will end up reporting when it finally gets to the police level is they never let the person talk. They always answer for them. And or you notice that the person always has the same clothes on. Although now with COVID, don't we all wear the same clothes? Mm-hmm. But that's a real common thing that just folks, neighbor folks, can notice. And interestingly, I live in a small enough suburb that the police actually go around to homes. They know, you have to tell them. They don't do FBI surveillance on you. But if you want a check, they go around to elders' homes and just make sure they're all right, which is a wonderful thing to be able to do. Make sure mm-hmm. they, you know, have food and have somebody to talk to. Sometimes if somebody had nobody to talk to, we have a couple of therapy dogs. And so they bring the dogs into the house. I mean, they really do a good job. But for the most part, most towns don't have that. And I suppose that's just sort of a good thing that as a neighbor, you can do. If you know an older person is living near you, just make sure you say, hi, how are you? And if they are living with a family member, just sort of keep an eye out. And you don't like to be suspicious of people. Most people are good and they're trying to do the right thing. But I think another thing that's common and that the police have found is contradictory stories. And implausible stories that someone's always falling. And then you say, well, if they fell, did you go to the doctor? Did they have a fainting spell? Do they have atrial fib? Do they have a problem? Oh, no, they didn't really need to go to the doctor. And then the story changes, you know, that sort of mm-hmm. thing. The same sort of thing, like with any group of lies. Or they're kind of chatting about grandma and they talk of them like a burden. And then if the elder does fall or has a bruise or something. Well, it's their own fault. And it's one of those things. You have to take each situation as it is, because on one hand, people who look overly protective can be abusers, or mm-hmm. people who completely ignore the elder. It's as though they're used to treating them like they don't exist, and which is probably more common, that it's they talk around them, talk past them, and they'll leave them at home. One of the things that we saw happen at the hospital is sometimes they'd come in the hospital for something, usually a broken hip repair, mm-hmm. and they'd never come back to get them. They just abandon them at the hospital. It is sad. And I think one of the things that makes it sad for Americans is it's not really our culture to take care of older folks. You talk to some people from other cultures, and if the elder has no children, then the cousins take care of them, then the neighbor takes care of them. That's not really how we've been, not certainly in this last century. Maybe we're getting that way. I hope we are. And whether it's by convenience, because more people have to live together because housing is expensive, or we actually are realizing the value that elders have and mm-hmm. that their life has value, just because they're old doesn't mean that they're useless. But this is where COVID has kind of brought some of these concepts out, is the whole nursing home problem.
Let's take our first break and delve into that when we come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. She's a board-certified anesthesiologist, and she's the past president of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. She's graduated from Stanford and earned her MD at UCSF Medical School. And she's completed 2 years of surgery residency at UCSF, then her anesthesia residency at Harvard's Beth Israel Hospital. And this is a person who's seen the healthcare system, and we talked about this on our show in the past, how it's changed. And the fact that we have a whole, to your mind's eye, COVID has this made it more poignant that people are, it's more obvious what's going on, because the seniors have been really on the front line of this whole COVID fiasco. They've been the first to be devastated by it. You know, they're losing their lives, they're losing their livelihoods, they're losing their ability to be independent, they're losing their ability to have connections. And I can't imagine, it's like being in jail. If you can't be with your loved ones, if you can't touch somebody, if you're on pins and needles waiting for your life to end, I can't even imagine living in that kind of emotional stagnation.
I either. And I know some people who still have not left their house. They have had food delivered from, you know, the grocery store, and they finally just went out in the backyard. And you know, what are you going to say if the person is that fearful? There's no mm-hmm. way you can talk them out of it and say, what's worse, never seeing anybody or getting sick from COVID? And I'm sure we'll get into it, you know, that perhaps people don't have to get sick from COVID mm-hmm. and probably didn't have to get sick from COVID well before the vaccine came out. But that's a story for a later moment. Everybody's heard about Cuomo in New York, but what happened in New York with those nursing homes has happened around the country. And California did a big study where we knew that kind of ground zero for COVID was in a nursing home back in February of last year. But between February and May, this was after they knew nursing homes were a problem, a quarter of the nursing homes had a resident who had COVID. And by August, 2/3 of the nursing homes residents had COVID. What were they doing in the meantime? You wonder, did they care? What's fascinating is they did a study, and this is just California, but it likely is transferable to the rest of the country, is that initially the ownership status of the nursing home mattered. The for-profit nursing homes had COVID cases 5 times higher than the nonprofits. So keep that in mind when you're choosing a nursing home. And something that's kind of obvious, the larger the nursing home, the more likely that people would have COVID. And that's, of course, there's just more people. And interestingly, which again is something you might assume, the nursing homes who had people who were over 85 had a 50% higher COVID positivity rate than, and a 70% higher death rate. Well, that fits with the COVID statistics. Men are more likely to get COVID. So nursing homes that had more men had more COVID deaths. And nursing homes where there was a high percentage of Black or Latinos had more deaths. So these are all things, most of these things are pretty obvious. And my big question was, why wasn't anybody doing anything about it all the way back in May? But then we asked that question, why did Governor Cuomo send these COVID positive people right back to a nursing home, a closed environment? And again, this isn't rocket science. They knew people in prisons were getting COVID because it was a closed environment. Mm-hmm. And so you would hate to think, well, nobody cares about old people. But we have enough other things that are going on just with the way old people are treated, where I guess I can believe it. Nobody cares about old people. And what's really sad, my last diatribe here, is CPR and DNR. When COVID came out, some of the nursing homes were sending out a new DNR form, and it kind of stressing people into wanting to sign, don't give me CPR if I have COVID. Well, wasn't cancer terminal. It's not a death sentence to get COVID. One can get better from COVID. Why would you suddenly, if you wanted to have CPR before, not want to have CPR? Well, guess what? People were complaining about CPR because of all the equipment that had to be used in order for, I mean, doctors are going to not do CPR because they're going to get spit on, you know, as an mm-hmm. anesthesiologist, you know, you get bodily fluids all over you when you do CPR, but mm-hmm. you're still going to do it. But if you have personal protective equipment on, that would have to be thrown away. So hospitals suddenly have a way higher cost to do CPR on a COVID patient because head coverings, air purifications, all this other stuff mm-hmm. that you'd have to use in that situation. So literally people were being told in some hospitals, well, if you have COVID, we might not give you CPR, and make sure you re-up your DNR status. And that they said if a person didn't have a DNR status right there, ready and available, that they would just choose not to give CPR. And, you know, no more cold blues. And actually arguing that, well, desperate times call for extreme measures. And that's when I just cringed when I saw that.
I can confirm that because it happened in hospital that I was on staff at, that they we got a letter stating that they had changed their policy back. At one point, they were running DNRs without family consent. And so now we're going to restart asking the family to sign the DNRs. So
wow.
You're right. Yeah. So, I mean, this was a, I think it was across the board. I don't think it was just the seniors. I think everybody who went up in the hospital had that possibility happen, especially with the fear of contamination and having enough personal protective equipment. I mean, it was really kind of a locked situation where unless you were up there, I don't think people really knew the extent of the duress that everybody was under. And I personally think of those of us who practice Hippocratic Oath medicine, I don't think that was a place that anybody who believed that would have thrived, to put it mildly.
Oh, but you know what's so sad? You know, it's kind of funny. We always come back to the concept of independent practice and speaking your own mind. So many people who were in these big systems have to toe the line for fear of losing their job. The one thing I can say about many of my colleagues, they know how to just say no and say, come on, you've pushed me too far.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to fire me because I want to save somebody's life, then I guess you'll have to fire me. They generally do not get fired when it's put that way.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure it's sad that just to work in a hospital, too many times, if you have a conversation like that with somebody, you make sure another person is present so you can validate that this person said, yes, you're supposed to let a person die. And of course, a hospital administrator is never going to come right out and say that.
You talk about politics in the macro, but hospital politics is extremely powerful when you're in it. My choice is always, if it's going against my oath and my ethics and morals, I'm pretty clear. I'm like, bye, you know, I'm not going to do it. But what's changed? I know it's another segue. We have a minute and a half, but have we changed as doctors that we've lost that ability to stand up on our back legs and say, we're not doing this, is unethical, immoral, against my oath, not doing it? Is that changed? I mean, is there a cutoff between what we trained, you and I, and what people coming out are doing now?
Oh, let's hope not, but I do see a change.
I mean, it just seems like there's this groupthink of healthcare. And there's no thought, it's just what you're told to do, passing down from top down, all these algorithms and UN and CDC driven things that when you look back at your training, they don't make a lot of sense. And we're going to take our break, so I'll let you answer that question when we come back. But let's take our second break. You're living in the solution.
Do you have problems with sinus pain and pressure? Do other people smell things that you don't? Have you lost the joy in eating because food just doesn't taste like it used to? Is your nose always stuffy no matter what you do? Maybe you have sinus or nasal polyps. These are generally benign growths that occur from a chronic sinus infection or allergies that are either undertreated or have not been treated at all. At Peachtree ENT Center, we specialize in minimally invasive balloon dilation surgery and correction of a deviated septum, as well as turbinate reduction surgery, all which can be done in the office. We use a state-of-the-art nasal telescope with a video camera so you can see the problem. You will be a partner in your care, and together we'll decide the course of action. Our philosophy is simple, to fix the problem, not just medicate the symptoms. But rest assured, all options will be offered before surgery is recommended, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts. Call 404-591-9100 or visit us at peachtreeentcenter.com.
Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. Not only is Dr. Singleton a physician, she's also a lawyer, and she attended UC Berkeley Law School. So this is somebody who understands constitutional law, administrative law, and those of us who are on the outside looking in, there's no rhyme or reason to what seems to be happening these days. How can this go unchecked? How can the good of the patient be subservient to a hospital administrator or the system? I think we're seeing that in the big picture, but let's talk about it on the micro level, on the hospital level, because COVID has been used as a bat to make people shut up, sit down, like it or lump it. I just don't think it's right.
Well, Dr. George, it's not right, but that's all part of having people so fearful that there's nothing you can do when you get COVID, and there is something you can do, and that you're going to die, and you're going to infect people if you don't have a mask on, and no critical thinking whatsoever. And the idea that everything you're doing is for the greater good. This is what this mask shaming is about. Now, I don't care whether you believe masks work or you don't think they work. There is no reason to curse at people on the street if they don't have a mask on, or call them names. If you really believe that person not having a mask on, that person that you don't know anything about, they could have cystic fibrosis for all you know, so that they're unable to wear a mask. How dare someone make some assumption that they're a bad person and call them names? And we've seen it on the street. Somebody just out in the fresh air, which it's been shown that if there's ventilation, you're not going to get a viral load. So people will yell out or say, "Don't you know? You're hurting other people." And that is very key, because what is that saying? You don't matter, but everybody else does. And so that's kind of being drummed into people that it's for the good of everybody, that your individual situation doesn't matter. We're looking out for the greater good. And that sort of mentality, well, let's face it, that's very anti-American. And as Americans, we do look out for other people. We do look out for our neighbors. We do help people out in the street. So we're not mean, nasty people who are selfish. But as a political worldview, the idea that the greater good is better than you as an individual is not how we think. And frankly, we were created to be individuals.
Correct.
And use our own minds. And so there is a change. And, you know, it's funny how you get people to change their minds. If somebody got up at the podium and said, "We're all going to change our society where you never think about yourself or your own needs, that everything you do is for the greater good," everybody would say, "Oh my goodness, that sounds crazy. I care about my family first." But look at how the language around COVID is. And like I said, like with this mask thing, "Oh no, you're protecting others." So it happens more subtly.
It does happen subtly, but there's a negativity or some sort of consequence. Either you're going to be physically hurt, you're going to have your business hurt. This is not out of altruism. They're making you toe the line based on what they potentially are trying to do to you, and it's negative. So it's bullying, you know, for lack of a better way to put it, and it's not real. Let's talk about the facts of COVID. What's the death rate in COVID? I mean, it makes it sound like if you get it, you're 99% going to be swept off the earth. Is that the truth?
No, it is not the truth. And the death rate, fortunately, you can look at it this way, is something that's graded. Children, now we've had a handful, but children tend not to die. Children tend to be asymptomatic. And as you get older, yes, there's a higher death rate. So, but if you put all the ages together, it's like, and we're talking about of people who were infected, not people who happen to just be members of this planet, that you're talking 1 in 10,000 if you get infected, if you're an older person. So yes, if you're over 85, yes, you have a higher chance of dying if you get it. This is why so many people are pushing for early treatment of COVID. Do you know that the CDC, even at this point, is still saying, if you get symptoms, just stay home and stay in bed and drink fluids, just as though it's a cold. And I think, okay, on one hand, they tell us it's not a cold, but then they tell you to act like it's just a cold because they don't want you to get the various early treatments that are out there. And I just find that strange when you can look at television and they're giving you a commercial for Abreva, some medicine to put on a cold sore as soon as you get it. So why can't we get medicine to treat COVID as soon as we get it? Something's wrong with this picture when a cold sore seems to be more important than COVID. It makes no sense.
I would have to agree absolutely with what you just said. It's an excellent example, actually. And, you know, what's the real truth about, because again, we've had a lot of virtual signaling going on and a lot of social justice going on. Are Black people more likely to die of COVID or not? Because we're making it sound like you have to line up first if you happen to be a Black person or a Latino, anybody of color.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because it is true that more Black people have died of COVID. However, you have to look at what the risk factors of COVID are. And so let's get this out of the realm of social justice. And I'm sure in some areas there is that issue, just like in some areas in deep rural America, there's white people that have no access to care, that it's that there is an access to care issue, but that may not be racial. That could be a difference of city versus country, etc. But if we look at this strictly medically, 75% of Black people have high blood pressure by the age of 55, compared to 55% of white men and 40% of white women. So Black people are more prone to high blood pressure. Okay, what is at the top of the list for people who get the sickest from COVID? High blood pressure. What's the second? And high blood pressure in this vie for first and second. Obesity. And again, not racist to say, it's just a number, that more Black people are obese than white people. And some of it's cultural, some of it's food. And we have to separate that out and say, okay, the medical risk factors are higher. And then that could be a whole discussion is why are the medical risk factors higher? Mm-hmm. And so and along with the obesity, we have diabetes. So diabetes is a huge risk factor. And people are working on that, trying to figure out why. And it looks like there is something about the fat cell and all that helps COVID virus replicate faster and all this, you know, and I'm not an immunologist, so I won't even go there. But looking at diabetes, obesity, and high blood pressure, these are more common in Black people and obesity more common in Latinos. And then we come to the fourth thing, and it's vitamin D levels. 63% of Hispanic people and 82% of Black people have low vitamin D levels because the darker your skin, the less vitamin D you take in. And there's now study after study that shows that vitamin D can lessen the severity of COVID disease. It's not going to keep you from getting it, but it can lessen the severity. So you look at all these factors, they're out there. And one of the things that gets to me is that nobody's talking about self-care. You don't hear these people saying, take your vitamin D, eat healthier foods. I sound like Popeye. Eat your spinach. That it's got all the things that are good for you. That's what we should be hearing on the news, not, oh, you know, X number of people died and there's nothing we can do about it and go out and get your vaccine. Well, before you get to that point, why don't we see more emphasis on all of us, no matter what race we are, taking better care of ourselves in the first place?
You know, from your lips to God's ears, and it's not just COVID, it's everything. It's always the treatment. It's never the prevention. And you mentioned something in passing, and we're going to take a break in a minute or so, but I wanted to go back to it. There are therapeutics that if you take them early, you can stop the slide of getting COVID. You can recover faster. And they don't require experimental treatment like the vaccine. It's experimental, let's be honest, right? It's new. Nobody really knows what the long-term effects are. But you do know things like hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or some of the other vitamins and how they have, there's protocol that's been used. There are safety studies from all of these that are years in the making, not just a couple of months out there. And the outcomes are the same, aren't they?
Yes. The outcomes are incredible. But going back to the cold sore example, you've got to give this stuff early. Because by the time the person's sick and in the hospital, it's too late for these treatments to work.
That's a really good point. And I think it was almost like it was set up to fail. Whatever studies they did initially, where people were really in extreme states, and then they were going to give them after the fact and then say, oh, it obviously doesn't work. It was a foregone conclusion. It's almost like you try to frame it in such a way that it would fail no matter what, so that you can come in with your expensive and hospital-based treatments where, you know, you have less of a chance of recovery when you're at that level of sickness. On that note, let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton, and we were telling, you know, the truth, frankly, about what really is going on with COVID and things that you don't hear generally on TV, because it's all about cases and mortality. And that's interesting. You have to actually listen to the language, don't you? Because initially it was all about mortality. And over the last several weeks, maybe a couple of months now, it's been about cases. But cases and mortality are two different things, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up the change in how people are describing this is cases. This PCR test that is done, that's the one where they stick the cotton up your nose and send it off to the lab, has changed what's positive and what's negative. It used to be that they do this test, and the way they ran it in the lab, they'd look for every last little particle that wasn't even live virus and say that's a positive test, even though the virus is dead and it might not even have ever been an active case. They were calling that a case. And now they lowered the threshold, or I guess raised the threshold of what they'd call a positive test. So now we can't even compare the numbers of infected people from 2 months ago to the numbers of infected people now, because they changed the way they did the test. How could they do this? They realized they were doing it wrong, but now the statistics mean nothing. And the other thing you saw in the news is they were calling every infection a case. Technically, epidemiologically, a case is someone who's sick, not someone who tests positive. And someone once told me, gee, what would happen if we just went around and drew blood from people for every single thing known to man? They may turn out to be positive and not know it. This happened to me as a medical student. I was working in a lab, and the lady who worked in a lab down the way was doing research on immunological treatment of cancer. So she was just drawing blood on everybody on the hallway just to see what kind of antibodies we had. And she came back to me and said, "Oh, you have tons of antibodies to Valley fever." Well, I didn't grow up in the Central Valley. I'd never been sick, but here I had all these antibodies. And that's how I kind of feel about this COVID thing. If we just went and drew blood on people, who knows what we'd find. But people are not sick. And I partially blame some of the medical folks who were involved in all this for letting that get out of hand, for letting the word case be used as just a positive infection, but not people who were sick, not people who were hospitalized. And then in my town, suddenly they shifted and started using hospitalizations because I think they realized the folly of just reporting everybody who had a positive test, because more and more people are positive just as time goes on, and people who never knew they were sick. So the whole point of lockdowns and the so-called flattening the curve was to make sure hospitals had enough beds. But if you really cared if hospitals had enough beds to take care of people, you'd try to keep them out of the hospital. And like you said, Dr. George, it's like they wanted to be in the hospital to use the expensive stuff when we have antiviral agents that work early, that have been around for 50, 60 years, and have been used safely. And this is where you wonder, are the dollar signs there? You hate to think that, but when there's cheap medicines that you can give somebody that have strong safety records, even if you want to believe in the camp that say, well, I don't think that works, that there's not enough studies that show that work. Well, if it does NyQuil work when you have a cold? Some people would say it doesn't, and all it is in NyQuil is alcohol that makes you fall asleep. But if it helps you, then use it. And I don't think that people should be afraid of using drugs that have been around when you have an illness that if you were to let it go to the stage where you start to get blood clots and start to get all the so-called cytokine storm where your body starts to attack itself. If you don't want to get to that stage, take medicine early.
I agree. I have a corollary question, because we talked about being asymptomatic and just testing positive, but the test not really, it doesn't correlate with illness or infection, really. It's just whatever they say it is. So this is my question. And as an, I guess, a respiratory specialist, because anesthesiologists deal with the lung as well, have you ever seen a respiratory infection be able to infect somebody when there's no symptom? So no fever, you're not coughing, you just have this fragment in your system based on a PCR test. In your opinion, can you actually infect somebody if that's what's going on?
Oh, and that's a huge question, because there's a couple huge studies that say asymptomatic people can't pass it on, and that's truly asymptomatic. And Dr. Birx, who used to be in the White House, had said, well, there's a difference of pre-symptomatic versus asymptomatic. And so I think she even had to say asymptomatic people don't pass it on, but perhaps the person that you ran into was going to get sick several hours later, and that's how they passed it on. And frankly, I don't think we know at this point. I've been looking at lots of these studies, excuse me, and many are contradictory. And so when you get these contradictory numbers, how can you say one way or the other?
I think you're right. But I always, who stands to gain and follow the money, right? And so whoever's underwriting these studies, they can give whatever answer they want. We both are scientists, so you know they can make a study look any way they want, depending on who they remove, how many people they add, how large the study is.
When they end the study, some of these studies, when they don't like how they're going, they just end them, and not because patients are dying or anything. They just don't like the way the numbers are coming out.
I mean, we have to have a conversation about academic medicine because it's affecting the entire world. And people who are pronouncing these things are not necessarily clinicians all the time. They're not doctors even. And they're making pronouncements as if they're on high. But there's no critical thinking going on. And they don't seem to ever adjust their rationale based on what's really going on the ground. Do you think that? I mean, it just seems...
Definitely, definitely. When clinicians, people who are actually treating patients, knock on the door of academia and say, this works, this is what I've found to work, they're mocked in many cases. And not even the intellectual curiosity to say, well, how did you figure that out? Or what kind of patients were they? Whatever. Mm-hmm. And I just think back to the doctor, I believe his name was Marshall, who came up with the idea that antibiotics were the proper treatment for peptic ulcers. They laughed at him. I mean, literally laughed at him and called him a fool. And when he cultured the bacterium, is called H. pylori, and cultured it out of the people's stomachs who had ulcers, and people were like, oh, wow, you were right. That was after years of mocking him. And do you know, several years later, he and the other fellow that worked on this with him got the Nobel Prize. So that's just a little lesson to people who make fun of clinicians who figure things out just because they've seen lots of patients. I mean, that's how Semmelweis figured out that you're supposed to wash your hands between patients. He saw that his colleagues who didn't wash their hands had more women die after childbirth. And he thought, there's a correlation here. He got people to start washing their hands. But he was made fun of. He was driven crazy by people telling him he was a fool. So it bothers me, given that history, and there's tons of other stories like that in medicine, where people just figure things out because they're on the ground working with patients, and have them be ridiculed, and then lo and behold, they're right. And do you think they get an apology? No.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, we're living a lesson at this point where up until this point, we do have some choices. That if you're a patient and you decide you want to go to a physician who's going to not be a cookie cutter, but think outside the box, you need to find that doctor so that you can give yourself and your loved ones the best chance of getting healthy. I don't think there's one way to do anything. I never did. But you should not have your choices taken away. That's really, to me, the most egregious thing that's come out of this COVID situation. And I think for me, from my standpoint, people I'm seeing, they're just done with it. They realize something is not right. It doesn't make sense. We only have a minute or so left, but I want to make sure people can find your blog, because you have a website and you write, and you also have the classes that you teach. So how can people find you?
At MarilynSingletonMDJD.com.
If people want to go to your classes, they can get that through the website as well?
Well, no, that's just local. So
okay.
Unless you live around Los Angeles, forget it.
If I did, I would be right up there. Trust me. I want to thank you so much for coming on. I always love having you on. It's like talking with the really, really dear friend. We all have to take responsibility for our health and stop letting people tell us what's best for us. I think that's the moral of the story, isn't it?
Absolutely. And just because you're a layperson doesn't mean that you can't use your own common sense. and use your common sense with regard to social distancing, masking, locking down. Obviously, if you're sick, do stay home and avoid people. If you're not sick, go out, get some fresh air, get some exercise that is good for you. And even though it's winter, there are sunny days. Get your vitamin D from the sun with the fresh air, and that will be something that will help you live through all this mess just a little bit more. And just know that there was a doctor named Dr. Farr, F-A-R-R, back in the smallpox days, who figured out with epidemics what goes up must come down, and that it's in a bell-shaped curve. And even with some mutations, this will end, so don't despair.
I think that's a great place to leave it. Thank you, Marilyn, for coming on. I can't wait to have you again.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.